WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is one of those family values stories for people whose families aren't traditional. It's a story that captures how miraculous and maddening it is to be a new mother, especially when you're single and you don't have much money. It's Anne Lamott's story. She's a writer known for her comic insights into contemporary life. She's the author of the novels All New People and Hard Laughter. She's been book critic for Mademoiselle and restaurant critic for California Magazine. Lamott lives in the San Francisco area. Her new book represents a big change in her writing and an even bigger change in her life. It's a journal of her son's first year called Operating Instructions. Her son Sam was born 3.5 years ago when she was 35. Here's a reading.
This is the very first entry, September 12, 1989. Sam is 2 weeks old today. His umbilical cord fell off. I'm probably supposed to feel like the cord is very lovely and natural, but I must say I'm going to be able to live without it somehow. It's like something a long-haired cat would get stuck in her tail. Sam is unbelievably pretty, with long, thin, Christ-like feet. I told my friend Carpenter this, and he said, "It's an often difficult world out there, and it's good to have long, grippy feet." I've decided the reason Sam's so gorgeous is that God knew I wouldn't have been able to fall in love with his horrible, colicky little bundle if he looked like one of those E.T. Don Rickles babies. I'm crazily tired. I feel as stressed out by exhaustion as someone who spent time in Vietnam. Maybe mothers who have husbands or boyfriends do not get so savagely exhausted, but I doubt it. They probably end up with these eccentric babies plus Bigfoot skulking around the house, angry because the mom is too tired to balance his checkbook or have sex with him. This is strictly sour grapes. I wish I had a husband. I wish Sam had a dad. I hope God sends him one someday. It's a huge thing not to have. Some friends of mine are having a baby in a couple of months, and they already know it's a boy and that he only has one whole arm, which of course is also a huge thing not to have. They are also going to call their baby Sam. The other Sam's father and I were both teaching at a writing conference in Napa a month ago, right before I delivered. I was massively pregnant, looking and feeling like a skinny, ugly teenager with a giant baby in her tum. Even the oldest black people at my church had been laughing when they saw me the week before. The other Sam's father and I were floating around a swimming pool, and I was thinking about how sad I feel sometimes because my dad is dead and he won't ever get to know Sam, at least on this funny blue marble. Then I got sad because Sam wasn't going to have some Alan Alda, Hugh Beaumont dad hanging around, throwing him up into the air, and teaching him how to do manly things, like how to pee standing up and how to fix a toaster oven. Thinking about the other Sam without much of a left arm and, of course, no left hand, my chest just ached. I pictured the two Sams at the fiction workshop the following year, hanging out together while we taught our classes, and my Sam studying the other Sam and saying, "So where's your arm?" And the other baby shrugging and saying, "I don't know. Where's your dad?"
That's Anne Lamott reading from Operating Instructions, a journal of her son's first year. Annie, can you tell us the story of how you became a single mother?
Well, there I was, having a not very good relationship with a man for about 3 months, and I found myself pregnant, and I'd had abortions before, and as I said in the book, I would take to the streets armed to defend the rights of women to have abortions, but I was 34 years old, and I just felt psychologically and psychically and emotionally unable to have any more abortions, and I'd always wanted to be a mother, but I thought, of course, that there would be some fabulous Bruce Springsteen-like dad to help me raise the child, and I was quite panicked, and the father was significantly less excited about the news than I was, really dramatically less excited, and so I talked to a lot of people, and I prayed about it, and I talked to my best friend Pammy, about whom the book is also largely about, and I just sort of waited. It was I think that's where the title came from, is that I wrote a little note to God and I said, "Look, I am willing to have another abortion if it would be a crummy life for this child to be born into." I wasn't making very much money at the time. And And I said, I'm really willing to have the baby, too, if there's a way for us to be provided for. And I'm just going to wait for my next operating instructions and try to keep my sticky little fingers off of the controls of the spaceship. And a couple weeks later, I had a very poignant and dramatic dream. And I woke up and said, well, for goodness sake, I guess I'm going to have a baby. And never looked back.
You allude to pressure on you to have an abortion. From who?
The father. The father, who was very, very large and very scary and was very upset.
Was he upset even if he didn't have to be responsible for the baby?
Yes, he was I think he was upset before I got pregnant. I think he was an upset person, but he was more upset. There was this awful, there's this little secret he was keeping, too, which was that 3 days after I found out I was pregnant, this young, voluptuous girl with huge hair and this sort of totally hair Barbie type moved in with him. So it was confusing for him to have gotten one woman pregnant who would not be a good sport about the whole thing and just go have an abortion. So...
What were your greatest fears about having a baby without being in a relationship?
Well, I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to make a living. It's such a precarious life to be a freelance writer, a novelist mostly. And curiously enough, I was finishing up my last book, All New People, when I got pregnant, since I was growing an all-new person in me. But I was afraid that I was too self-centered and mentally ill and driven by my creativity and my self-centeredness to be able to love a child. And it seemed like if there was a father around, at least when you really were losing your mind and coming unraveled, you could hand the baby over and go for a walk. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that a lot of the time. That was frightening for me. I was afraid that I wouldn't write again. I was afraid that I'd be too exhausted, and I also had a fear that I would get too well, that having a baby would fill me up so that I wouldn't have this same carrot dangling in front of me that had helped me get a lot of writing done over the years. You know, the writing and successes along the way are just such a great hit, and it's so tempting. It's so filling and fulfilling, and it just keeps you longing for more. And I was afraid that if I had somebody to love so deeply and who was probably going to be loving me back, that it was going to take away a lot of my incentive.
Has it?
No, not at all. It's just the opposite. One thing that it did do that I think is good for my writing is that it put me in touch with my pathological rage, because I had spent all of these years thinking I was, you know, Desmond Tutu and... just the kindest, mellowest, nicest person you ever met. And after I had a baby, you know, I just lost my mind. There's that section in the book where it talks about thinking I would look like somebody from Walton Mountain when I had my little baby in my arms. And instead, I was stalking around the house looking like the old ads for the Boston Strangler. And I had never known that I was so angry. And it just unleashed a barrage of fury and frustration that made my hands tremble sometimes. And I've never heard him, but I've actually put my fist through the wall of the new house we're in, although I hope my landlord's not listening, because I was going to pin it on the last tenants. But but so I think that's good. I mean, I think to know that the anger is there is a good thing, and then you can share it, you know. And it was very important to me when I was writing this book that I just give away as much of the truth as I could to other mothers, especially single mothers. I thought it might be a good book for single mothers because it's just such a relief when someone tells the truth and says that you're angry and depressed and lost and catatonic a lot of the time. You know that you're not being Barbara Billingsley and that it's okay and that it's very human. And it was such a freeing thing for me when other mothers would share that it hadn't been a bed of roses. And I love that Toni Morrison line that the function of freedom is to free someone else. And I really felt like if I could capture the craziness and the ups and downs and the roller coaster ride, that it would be a real gift for other mothers.
You write, I wonder if it's normal for a mother to adore her baby so desperately and at the same time think of choking him or throwing him down the stairs. What would make you most angry at Sam, your baby?
Exhaustion and always the constant worry about finances. And I'd be exhausted. I felt there at one, there's an entry in the journal that says I don't think he's handling things very maturely, you know, so that I'd be exhausted and broken, scared and tense, and I wouldn't have gotten any sleep. And then he was colicky, so for a couple of months he cried every night from about 5 till 10, and I'd be a really good sport and I'd kind of rise to the occasion for about 2 hours, and then I would just feel beside myself, and I feel like I really literally didn't know what to do, and what helped was to call people and to talk to them about it and to tell the exact truth about it. And you know, it's like they say that the truth will set you free, although it'll make you miserable first, you know, and that's really very much what happened.
You also describe the sense that your baby was ruining your life because you used to not care what happened one way or another, and you know, even if you like died young or something, you could handle that, but it was a different ballgame now.
Yeah, definitely. All those years, up until I was 34 years old, I really lived hard and I drank a lot and I smoked non-habit-forming marijuana on a daily basis for 20 years, and I felt like I'd lived a really wild and intense and rich life. I had lots of friends, but I had this sort of bohemian sense that if I did die young, which wouldn't have surprised me, that I would have really packed a lot of living into those years. All of a sudden, when you have a baby, there is something so huge at stake, you know, and all of a sudden, there's something that I could lose that I could never bounce back from. There's something I could lose that I felt would effectively end my world, and that's a lot worse for me than thinking about dying myself, because I know Sam would be covered. He's got a really great tribe, but for me, you know, all of a sudden, when you can lose a child, it's, you know, that your life can be, the candle can be snuffed out.
You describe yourself as a very jealous person, so jealous that reading a bad review of a book written by an acquaintance of yours was as much fun as Christmas.
Right.
So how jealous have you been of women who had children and a husband they love?
I have been very jealous of everybody. I'm jealous of you. I'm jealous of the engineer here. And
You're jealous of my engineer also?
I'm jealous of your engineer, who I've never even seen, you know, and I'm bitter and upset about all the things that she has in her life that I don't have. And but I'm really struggling with it, and I'm really wanting to write about it, and it's that same thing. I want to be able to tell the truth about it. I think it's such a huge gift to give it away and to talk about this stuff that you're not supposed to talk about. And just telling the truth about that, like telling the truth about motherhood, is such a subversive and revolutionary act, because there's so little of it in the popular culture. But the truth is that I've really grappled with jealousy, and I've really come a long way. And I still find that when people tell me about great material windfalls, that I feel worried. I feel like I get stuck in the illusion that there's not enough to go around, and that if people are getting a lot, they're getting some of mine, that mistakes have been made. And I actually even feel this way about God. I feel if other people are too spiritual or religious, that they're sucking up some of my share of God and that my hit will be diluted. So,
writer Anne Lamott is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Anne Lamott has written a journal of her son's first year. It's called Operating Instructions. You had been sober for about 3 years when you had your baby, Sam. Was that first year a difficult period to abstain? Were there pressures on you that made you think, oh, boy, would I like a drink?
The first, after I had Sam?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, PMS was a reason for me to think that maybe I should knock back a few social vodkas just to take the edge off. So, but the thing is that I knew if I went to a liquor store or a bar, that when I put the money on the counter, I'd have to put Sam on the counter too, and the car keys and everything I have that's of any value to me, because I knew I would lose everything if I started drinking again. And, you know, I felt a lot of terrible feelings. I felt really lonely and scared a lot of the time, and you know, my self-esteem was lower than Kafka's cockroach at times, because I thought I was doing such a poor job. And of course, there are times when I wanted just something just to make the corners smoother, but I just didn't. You know, I always think, well, I can drink tomorrow and probably will, but I don't think I will for the rest of the day. And then, you know, the next hour would be better.
Mm-hmm. Something very terrible happened the same year that Sam was born. Your best friend of 25 years, Pammy, who was also your birth coach, found a lump in her breast, and she died of breast cancer that same year.
No, she didn't. She died in last year, November
oh,
of
sorry.
1992.
I'm sorry.
She was sick for a couple of years.
Oh, okay. It's still such a shock to me that, I don't know, that someone can find a lump and be gone that quickly. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's a nightmare. I mean, it's something that simply can't be happening. And then there's really nothing in your brain pan that can accommodate this information, since there's no way that this one thing can happen. She was the person I was most connected to. We'd been best friends for 25 years, and she was helping me raise Sam. In fact, she was very clear about how after Sam was born, about seeing me as the incubator that made it possible for her and Sam to be together, because they fell so desperately in love with each other. And it was excruciating. It's what the last third of the book sort of centers around, is that the one person besides Sam that I couldn't live without was going to be dying. And it really was the end of the world, and it was the end of the world in November when she died. And but it also has been, I hate it when people talk like this. I always look at them like they're Scientologists or something, but it's been a huge gift. You know, it was a huge gift for us to spend 2.5 years together when she was sick, and she ended up having a baby also, and so we had these two little kids, and the stakes were so high, and the awareness of the present moment and of immediacy and of spirit and of nature and of caring were so huge for both of us that it just increased it made my heart so big. And it's like the Dalai Lama said when he came to America to Harvard Divinity School to accept a big prize. He said, the purpose of life is to increase the warm heart. And it really increased my heart. And I felt like it nearly killed me, but then it didn't. And it transformed me in a way that I don't think anything else except for Sam's birth has. And the grief was just unbelievable, and I'd been afraid. I was 38 when she died. I'd been afraid for probably 36 years that if I ever started to grieve, that it would be a black river that would just wash me out past the Golden Gate Bridge, and I would be destroyed by it. But it turned out to be much more like oxygenated blood to a wound or something, and I began to find parts of my being come back that I hadn't even known were still there. She taught me so much stuff that I can't wait to tell Sam. You know, Sam speaks English, but he's 3.5, and we don't have these incredible in-depth philosophical discussions. But she said a few things, like the thing that I think that changed me most was that she was in a wheelchair at the end, and she had this wig on, and we used to go shopping a lot at the mall when we would get too depressed or too bored, and because I saw her every day for 3 months, and she'd just be exhilarated in her wheelchair. She said she felt like a cross between the Queen Mum and Easy Riders, and we called it doing retail therapy, and we'd go to the mall and charge things to her husband's accounts. And one day I went to buy this little dress to go out with the man I was with at the time, and I put it on, and it was real cute, and it was on sale. And I turned to her and I said, "Do you think this makes me look big in the hips?" And she said, "Annie, you don't have that kind of time." And so she's been dead for 6 months, and I hear that ringing through the chambers of my mind all the time when I start to get fixated on something small or neurotic or self-seeking or whatever. I think, "Annie, you don't have that kind of time."
Was Pammy the first friend that you lost?
No. I've actually lost a lot of friends. I worried for a while that I might be a carrier or something. My father died, if you probably know from reading Hard Laughter, of brain cancer when I was 25, and he was the person, besides Pammy, that I was closest to all those years. And then my publisher and very beloved friend Bill Turnbull, who was a publisher of North Point Press, who did two of my books, died a couple of years ago of stomach cancer, and that was really excruciating. I was with him and his wife when he died, and it just seems like for whatever reason, maybe God thinks I'm well enough to be around dying people, and I don't feel too freaked out by it, although my heart is broken and I tend to cry more. But Pammy said something I thought was sort of interesting, because so many people around her wanted to help her spirit stay high and wanted to keep her feeling positive about the transformation that she was going through. And we'd lie on her bed and eat chocolate and watch Oprah and the other talk shows, and I'd just cry. And she said, the biggest gift you give me is that you're so profoundly depressed about this. And about 2 months before she died, we'd done the retail therapy, and we'd really had a lot of fun. And that day, we'd really been laughing a lot. And I just looked at her, and I said, I just don't want you to die. And she said, you know, no one said that to me yet.
In the early part of your journal, you wrote that you were afraid that you were much too self-centered, cynical, eccentric, and edgy to raise a baby, especially to raise that baby alone. How do you feel about that now?
Well, I feel that it's all true, except that one day at a time I keep getting enough to go on so that I feel that Sam's having a really great childhood and that he is loved out of all sense of proportion by the people around him. He's got men that spend lots and lots of time with him every week and that he feels deeply loved by, and he's got women and he's got grandparents. These people at the church also, like Pammy, see me as this incubator that made it possible for them to be with Sam, and I was just sort of the middle step. But so and then I'm always aware, you know, I'm always aware of a lot of stuff in me that springs from fear and low self-esteem and worry and the need to have crisis and drama, and I'm trying to grow past that, and I'm struggling, and it's painful, and I keep feeling that one day at a time I keep getting enough new operating instructions to do just about all right with me and Sam. It reminds me, it's not all that different from writing a novel where, you know, about every couple of months or something, you think, well, that's it. The well is run dry. It's over. The jig's up. You know, they are going to call me and tell me that I don't get to be a writer anymore and that I have to get a job with a phone company and I better get some decent clothes. And, you know, you come up against this wall over and over in the middle of a three-year or two-year writing project. But I always think of what E.L. Doctorow said in an interview a few years ago when he said that writing any long-sustained piece of fiction is like driving in a tule fog at night where you can see about 2 or 3 feet in front of you in the headlights, and that's plenty. You don't need to see where you're going, and you don't need to see that much more of the road. And that's what I always tell my writing students, and that's actually what I tell myself a lot of the time in terms of being a mother.
Anne Lamott is the author of the new book, Operating Instructions, A Journal of My Son's First Year. She lives in the San Francisco area. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.